Maximum Cavalera Tour, Soulfly with guests Insight and Lottie Kong. February 21st at Venue. Tickets at unionevents.com, Scrape Records, or Ticketmaster. I see the red sea parting from the
mare. I see the desert cloud split up. $1 billion on the ground, all stretched out and uncurled, would extend about four times around the circumference of the world. Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the West End at
212 Productions Limited, The Baker and the Chef, Bang on T-shirts, Vistude Records, Dream Apparel and Articles for People, Dunleavy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattoo, Fortune Sound Club, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinemathic, Perch, Project Space, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or online at citr.ca.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening. Today is Friday, February 1st. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Morgan Yee. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:06 and time for a full hour of independent news. Today, our headlines will cover provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world, brought to you by Free Speech Radio News. This plus your weekend weather forecast, brought to you by Phil from the UBC Storm Club, right here on News 101, your source for independent news.
First up, we have some excerpts from today's Idle No More teach-in held at the UBC First Nations House of Learning, an event which drew standing room only crowd with a large number of students, staff, and community members in attendance. This event was also broadcast live this afternoon by CITR. Here now we present some highlights of the speeches given by Shelley Johnson, Gordon Christie, Dory Nason, and Glenn Coulthard.
And I thought, what the heck is Idle No More? I've only been out of the country for a week. What happened? And so I started reading more and more about it, what was available online, and I found out that, of course, this movement was started by four women from Saskatchewan. 3 First Nations women and 1 non-First Nations woman. So there wasn't a surprise to me. I mean, our families, my community is matrilineal. And so immediately I got interested. And I started to read lots of articles, what was online and newspaper articles. And then I got to the comments section on the online article. And I started to read the responses. And some of the responses were really well informed, very well articulated. They had lots of factual information. And I could see that lots of people were really struggling to understand what this Idle No More movement was about and inform themselves about the issue. And, you know, as a consequence, we're here today. But some of the comments that I read weren't that well informed. And as a social worker, it immediately made me curious about why that is. And so I kept reading and I saw, you know, some of the comments were racist, some of them were pretty derogatory, and some were pretty ill-informed. And the thing that sort of embarrassed me is that I was in Chile at the time and those comments were there for the whole world to see. And it gave me pause to consider myself, and to consider for me, you know, is that the kind of comments that I'd like my children to read? Is that the kind of comments I'd like my grandchildren to read? And one of the things that I've learned in being a parent is that, you know, my children don't really listen to a lot about what I say, but I've learned over the years that they watch everything that I do. And so I thought, what can I do, you know, to help people to understand that, you know, I don't make choices about what I'm going to do based on a 2 or 3 year Indian Act enforced legislation kind of election cycle or a 4 year provincial or federal government election cycle. As a Soto woman, I make decisions based on what's in the best interest of my children and my grandchildren. And I thought about what kind of world do I want to leave with them? And is this the kind of Canada where people are divided and we really don't know one another very well? Is that the kind of place that I want to leave for them? And so I thought, what can I do? So seeing those sort of ill-informed, racist kind of comments really was a gift for me in lots of ways. Because it was a relief. I thought, finally here, we don't have to pretend anymore in this society that we are rights-based protectors, all of us. You know, somehow racism stops at our borders and we're not impacted by it. It's not in our educational institutions, it's not in our legislature, it's not in our policies and practices, it's not in our relationships, because it's there, it's evident, it's clear for us all to see. And so I thought, what kind of relationship do we want to go forward with? And I thought, well, here, this has opened an opportunity for us to talk about our treaty relationships, the ones that I know existed before Canada existed for the people in Saskatchewan, to talk about our mutual obligations and to consult one another and talk about how do these things that are being brought forward in government, how do they impact you, how do they impact me, and how do we go forward together?
Say that one thing that's really concerning is that this legislation that's been passed the last year or so has been impacted on Aboriginal treaty rights. And I think a lot of Canadians are interested in that, but they don't really know much about Aboriginal treaty rights. So I just want to talk a bit about that. That's the aim of my 10-minute talk here. I'm going to go back in history, because you have to. Canada has a long history in this regard. And go back to the 1600s up to the 1700s. It was a 200-year period or so when the British Crown was in the business of interacting with indigenous peoples in North America. And they built up a policy for how they would interact with indigenous peoples. And it became a policy that was articulated in what's called the Royal Proclamation in 1763. The king at that time issued a proclamation that captured the heart of this policy of how the crown was dealing with indigenous peoples. And that became the policy that informed treaty making across this country from 1850 roughly up until 1923 when the big historic treaties were being signed and negotiated. And this policy unfolded as Canada unfolded across the country. You know, it went from basically east to west and up to north. And there's a sense to it. You know, it's obviously what had to be done, and the British Crown recognized this. You can't move into a territory occupied by the people without talking to them and getting their consent. And that's the nature of the treaties. And I want to suggest to you that the treaties across Canada are constitutional documents. And the courts are on the edge of accepting this. They haven't gone all that way. And I think it just has to be that way, because that's the only way to understand treaties. Without treaties, we wouldn't have Canada. That's simple. So they're obviously constitutional documents, documents that constitute the country. They would allow everybody in this room here to be here and to think of themselves as Canadians. And it's a point that's been made by many people, and I just want to reiterate this point. Everybody in this room is a treaty person. Shelley mentioned that she's from a treaty in Saskatchewan. You are all treaty people. I assume, well, there may be some Americans here. I'm assuming you're all Canadian. If you're Canadian, then you're a treaty person, because the treaties are relationships between Canadian society and Aboriginal people, and they're what constitute the country. And they form then sets of agreements that set out how we're going to live together. That's how they constitute these relationships. So when people talk about treaty rights, they mean rights that treaty nations have and that Canadians have. And you should be concerned then, if you're not from a treaty nation, you should be concerned if treaty rights are being impacted on, because they're tied to you too. Everybody has these rights tied to them. On the other side of rights are obligations, right? That's the way rights work. If somebody has a right, then other people have obligations. That's what rights are. They create powers that people have, and they create obligations that other people have in relation to those rights holders. So, there's a complicated set of relationships that were established from these treaties. And if people don't understand the treaties, and they don't make sure the government's holding up its end of these agreements, then we're all in a constitutional mess. What's happening now is that the current government is trying to ignore these treaties. And they're trying to say that they're not constitutional documents, that they can play with them and just change them at their will. Well, that is creating a constitutional crisis. They don't see it that way. I think Prime Minister Harper doesn't see it that way, but he's wrong. Because they are the documents that create the country. And if you play with the documents that way, you're messing up with the foundations of the country.
What inspires me as an Anishinaabekwe, a Chicana, and as an Indigenous feminist about Idle No More is that this movement showcases, like so many other examples in Native history, the endless love Indigenous women and Indigenous youth have for their families, their communities, their lands, their nations, and themselves as Native people. These profound forms of love motivate Indigenous women all over the world to resist and protest, to teach and inspire, and to hold accountable both Indigenous and non-Indigenous allies to their responsibilities. Responsibilities that include protecting the traditions, values, and ways of being that serve as the foundation for Indigenous women's relationships to land and their human right to bodily sovereignty. A framework that ensures these things remain intact and free from violation. Women in the movement seek to protect the waters, the environment, and their families from the threat of further destruction. Notice I did not say that women are demanding protection for themselves, but they seek protection of those values, practices, and traditions that respect women's power and sovereignty that have been and remain under attack, the core of a settler colonial misogyny that refuses to acknowledge the ways it targets Indigenous women for destruction. It is an important distinction, I think, and I would humbly ask folks to think about what it means for men, on the one hand, to claim the responsibility to protect our women, and on the other, take leadership positions that uphold patriarchal forms of governance. But that is another subject for another time. What women in Idle No More have shown is that they are powerful and organized and persistent, and this makes us targets. This has always been so. The movement reveals reasons why Indigenous women's love is answered by settler society with epidemic levels of violence, sexual assault, imprisonment, and cultural and political disempowerment. Because the colonizer has always known that to counter the power of Indigenous womanhood, you need to make acceptable the practice of hating Indian women. To normalize this hatred and violence, you must render Native women's power to love and to inspire as something insidious. Their power and their love for who they are and where they come from becomes distorted in mainstream consciousness. And those distortions become the narratives and images society pulls from in times like these. When Native women's love inspires a nation to round dance, question destructive environmental policy, or demands justice for children living in substandard conditions, is when other forces counter this with vitriolic hate. It is at this point that we see the power of Indigenous women's love turned into something ugly in the mainstream media. This love becomes something self-serving, opportunistic, and a lie. Or as Anishinaabe scholar Leanne Simpson has shown in her beautiful essay about Chief Spence's sacrifice, settler colonial misogyny could turn something as sacred as a Native woman's ceremonial fast for her people into a publicity stunt, a cynical smokescreen, and a senator's ugly joke.
So today I want to structure my comments with the aim of challenging a significant and, to my mind, problematic restraint that is increasingly being placed on Idle No More movement, both from within our own communities and from without, by mainstream Canadians. This constraint involves the type of tactics that are being represented as morally legitimate in our efforts to defend our land and rights as Indigenous peoples, on the one hand, and those which are increasingly looked at as either morally illegitimate or at least politically self-defeating because of their disruptive, extra-legal, and therefore potentially alienating character on the other. With respect to those approaches deemed legitimate in defending our rights, emphasis is usually placed on formal negotiations, usually carried out by official Aboriginal leadership and representatives of the Crown, and if need be, coupled with symbolic acts of peaceful, non-disruptive protests that abide by Canada's, quote, rule of law. Then there are those approaches increasingly deemed illegitimate. These include, but are not limited to, the forms of direct action that seek to influence power through less mediated and sometimes more disruptive measures, like the slowing of traffic for the purposes of leafletting, temporarily blocking access to Indigenous territories with the aim of impeding the exploitation of First Nations lands and resources, or in rarer cases still, the more or less permanent repossession of a portion of Native land through the establishment of a reclamation site, which also serves to disrupt, if not entirely block, access to Indigenous peoples' territories by the powers of state and capital. Regardless of whether or their specificity, most of these approaches get branded in the media as a typical Native blockade, militant, threatening, and disruptive. The following are two typical positions regarding the use of these direct action tactics to defend Indigenous peoples' rights and interests. The first I draw from a recent statement by the former National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Ovid Merpity, when he suggested at a recent leadership gathering that it is, quote, only through talk, not through blockades, that real progress will be made. The assumption here, of course, is that most productive means to forge real change in the lives of Indigenous communities and people is through negotiation. The second example is perhaps less surprising. It's drawn from a statement made earlier this month by the emotionless ideologue himself, Prime Minister Harper. People have the right in our country to demonstrate and express their points of view peacefully as long as they obey the law. But I think the Canadian population expects everybody will obey the law in holding such protests. So I want to focus on two arguments. There's more than two, but I'll focus on two, that typically get used when critics rail against the use of more assertive forms of Indigenous protest actions. The first argument is the one clearly articulated by Mercury in the statement I just quoted. Negotiations are, objectively speaking, simply more effective in securing the rights and interests of Indigenous people. This is simply false. Historically, I would venture to suggest that all negotiations over the scope and content of Aboriginal peoples' rights in the last 40 years have piggybacked off of the assertive direct actions, including the escalated use of blockades, spearheaded by Indigenous women and other grassroots elements of our community. For example, there would be no negotiations over Aboriginal rights and title in British Columbia through the current land claims process if it weren't for the ongoing commitment of Indigenous activists willing to put their bodies on the line in defense of their lands and communities. There would have been no Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, which for over 5 years investigated the abusive relationship between Indigenous peoples and Canada through 178 days of public hearings in 96 communities across Canada, without the land-based direct actions of the Innu in Labrador, the Lubicon Cree in Alberta, the Algonquins of Barrier Lake, the Mohawks of Ganasetake and Ganawagi, the Haida of Haida Gwaii, the Anishinaabe of Temagami, and the countless other communities across Canada which put themselves directly in harm's way in their defense of their lands and their ways of life. there would have been no public inquiry into the hundreds of murdered and missing Aboriginal women in Vancouver and across the country if it weren't for the thousands of Indigenous women and their allies who have taken to the streets every year for well over a decade to ensure that state-sanctioned sexual violence against Indigenous women stops here and now. All of this is to say that if there has been any progress in securing our rights to land and life, including through the largely male-dominated world of formal negotiations, this progress is owed to the courageous activists of these diverse communities. The second argument that gets used to denounce or criticize more disruptive forms of Indigenous direct action involves these actions' supposedly self-defeating or alienating character. The idea here being that insofar as these tactics disrupt the lives of perhaps well-intentioned but equally uninformed non-Native people, First Nations will increasingly find themselves alienated and our causes unsupported by average working-class Canadians. I have two brief points to make here. First, I think that in general terms, getting this reaction from the dominant society is simply unavoidable. Movements like Idle No More have within their sights, now more than ever, a restructuring of the fundamental relationship between Indigenous peoples and Canada. For two centuries, this relationship has run roughshod over the rights of Indigenous nations, which has resulted in the stockpiling of a massive power and privilege for non-Native people. Land has been stolen, and some of it is going to have to be given back. Power and authority have been illegitimately appropriated, and some of it will have to be reinstated. This will inevitably be upsetting to some. It will be very inconvenient to others. But it's what needs to happen if we are to create a just, sustainable life in this country for the bulk of Indigenous communities, and importantly, for the majority of non-Indigenous peoples as well.
And once again, that was Shelley Johnson, Gordon Christie, Dory Nason, and Glenn Coulthard speaking today at the Idle No More teach-in at UBC. You can access the full proceedings online at citr.ca in the form of a podcast. And we're going to take a very quick PSA break, but stay with us for local and national headlines.
$1 billion on the ground, all stretched out and uncurled, would extend about four times around the circumference of the world.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, Temple of the Modern Girl Boutique, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or online at citr.ca.
I'm gonna be round my vegetables, I'm gonna chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub. It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies.
It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce.
It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
And welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. And we now go to our local and national headlines.
Major crimes investigators remained at a Vancouver apartment building through the night, trying to determine why a man ran through the hallways on Thursday evening randomly slashing at residents. 7 people were injured on several floors of the West End high-rise, and Sergeant Randy Fincham, says one of those victims, a woman, remains in critical condition. Of the 6 treated in hospital, Fincham says the woman and 3 other people are still receiving care, while 2 victims were released overnight. The victims were treated at the scene and will be all right. Fincham says the suspect remains in custody and more information about him will be released as soon as it is available. Officers don't believe the man lived in the building, and they say the vicious attack appears entirely random because there are no apparent links between the man and any of his victims.
A group passionate about getting the Waldorf Hotel protected as a heritage building has published a report hailing it as a rare remnant of the post-World War II art modern architectural style. Solterra, the company that became the 65-year-old building's third owner ever, on January 6th, has said it has no intention of demolishing it, but just in case, City Council passed a 120-day temporary protection order soon after it changed hands. The city is commissioning its own full report on the Waldorf's heritage and cultural value, which is due early May, but urban planner Holly Foxcroft said she delivered a separate report to a senior city heritage planner on Wednesday. Foxcroft wrote the 72-page report with input from architects, planners, and community members. The statement of significance includes dozens of archival photos of the Waldorf, spanning from its earliest days to the 2010 renovations that returned it to its former glory as an East Vancouver cultural hub. It details the painstaking efforts made to protect its heritage features, such as the Tiki Bar that is the oldest in Canada, the large collection of Edgar William Leetag paintings, and murals painted by noted artist Peter Hopkinson. Brian Jackson, the city's general manager of planning and development, said via email he was surprised by the amount of work that went into the paper.
A public meeting has finally been called to discuss the drama between the Park Board and the associations that run Vancouver's community centres. The Park Board wants to create universal access passes between the centres and to control and equally split all revenue each centre collects going forward. The associations, however, believe this quote-unquote cash grab will reduce their ability to provide services and centralize power at City Hall. They don't want to be punished for managing money properly and running surpluses. NPA Park Board commissioners have accused the Vision Board members of muzzling them and not engaging properly with the public. Board Chair Sarah Blythe said, "Feedback from associations is welcome, but they do not want to make a decision to work towards the quote-unquote best possible system." Sorry, they do want to make a decision to work toward the best possible system. The public meeting takes place on February the 4th.
6 universities across British Columbia warned that the province is facing a severe shortage of skilled workers, and there's barely 36 months to resolve the problem. According to the Research Universities Council of BC, the number of jobs requiring university, college, or trades credentials will exceed the supply of BC graduates by 2013, and the deficit will expand for most of the next decade. A report from the council estimates that nearly 19,000 jobs could go unfilled by 2020 because of a lack of necessary training, with the majority of those vacant jobs requiring a university or college degree. The council, which includes members from UBC, SFU, the University of Victoria, the University of Northern British Columbia, Thompson Rivers University, and Royal Roads, bases its estimates on the provincial government's BC labor market outlook. Council members offer 3 proposals to fill the skills gaps, including creation of 11,000 university, college, and trades training spaces over the next 4 years, along with more grants, scholarships, and other improvements to student aid. They also want to launch Innovate BC, an initiative to unite efforts by government, businesses, and post-secondary institutions to build research and innovation potential across the province, driving economic growth.
Opponents of the Northern Gateway Pipeline are threatening to turn their sights on CN Rail as at least one Alberta oil company explores the possibility of transporting oil sands crude to the BC coast by rail. 16 environmental groups have signed a letter to CN CEO Claude Mongeau, questioning the rail industry's safety record. The letter specifically cites a 2005 train derailment that spilled thousands of liters of oil and toxic chemicals into Lake Wabamun in Alberta, and another accident the same year that dumped caustic soda into the Chickamauga River, killing 500,000 fish and poisoning the river for kilometers. The group says that if CN decided to move forward with oil transport plans, it would face major opposition and risks to the company. Production in Alberta oil sands has outstripped pipeline capacity, and several projects have been proposed to expand Pacific exports, including Enbridge's Northern Gateway pipeline into Kitimat and an expansion of Kinder Morgan's existing pipeline into Metro Vancouver.
And those are your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for your provincial and national headlines, as well as the weather by Phil Chang.
$1 billion on the ground, all stretched out and uncurled, would extend about four times around the circumference of the world.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the West End at
Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books and Sound, Baru Latino Restaurante, The Bike Kitchen, Cove, Dentry's Pub, Displace Hatchery, Limelight, The Eatery, Fresh is Best Salsa, Gargoyles, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or online at citr.ca.
The world's most shocking monster.
That techno rock you guys listen to is godless.
I'm sure.
And the only reason you don't understand our music is that you don't like it.
After I'm gone, your Earth will be free to live out its miserable span of existence.
Can anyone stop their mechanical mayhem?
All of my most sensitive areas were inflamed. My extremities pulsating with tingling sensation.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology.
Swaying back and forth. A beautiful thing taking me away.
You are a robot.
You must listen to Synaptic Sandwich. Saturday nights from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. on CITR FM 101.9.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. We now have your weekend weather forecast brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Hi, Phil.
Hey, CJ. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. So, scattered cloud cover today on all three altitude levels. So we only got a peep of sunlight until around 4 o'clock when the lower level clouds let up and we got consistent daylight. In the forecast for this weekend, it looks like a sunny weekend with patches of cloud. Thanks to a high pressure system centered to the south of us, there appears to be very little dynamic activity at all, so that includes wind. On Sunday night, when the first part of a frontal section of a rainy low may reach us, we could see a little bit of precipitation, up to 3 millimeters. Finally, one last thing to look out for is some fog tonight from the high pressure system in the greater Metro Vancouver area. Now, the official forecast from Environment Canada. Tonight, increasing cloudiness early this evening with 30% chance of showers, low of +4. Saturday, cloudy, showers beginning in the morning, high of 7. Saturday night, showers late into the evening, then cloudy with 40% chance of showers, low of +4. Sunday, rain, high of 6. So that's this weekend's weather forecast, brought to you by Environment Canada as well as the UBC Storm Club. From Storm Club, I'm Phil Chang, reporting weather for News 101.
Thank you, Phil. That sounds interesting. We shall see how it goes moving forward.
It's going to be sunny. Be happy, man.
That's true. But you never know. Mm. Things can change. All right. So that was your weekend weather forecast. Thank you, Phil. And we now go to free speech. We have one interesting international science news. 10 years ago, the Science Magazine and the National Science Foundation, or NSF, launched an international competition to recognize the best examples of projects that bring scientific information to life. The goal was to encourage new ways to visualize data efforts that are increasingly important for conveying scientific principles and ideas across disciplines and to the general public. Projects reveal the hidden beauty of scientific structures on scales from as small as nanometers to as large as the universe. Named the International Science and Engineering Visualization Challenge, this year, on its 10th anniversary, a total of 215 entries were participating, originating from 18 different countries. To fairly determine the merit of these creative scientific projects, a panel of experts in scientific visualization were brought in to select 5 different categories: photography, illustration, graphics, games or apps, and video. Also, a public vote selected a People's Choice winner. The winners and runner-ups have been featured online today on both Science Magazine and National Foundation's website, National Science Foundation's website. You can visit it at www.nsf.gov/news/SEIVIS or www.sciencemag.org and go from there to see the winning pieces. And that was interesting international news. We now go to Free Speech Radio News for our international segments.
Continues to be a national concern, both on and offline. Health experts say that bullying can lead to depression, anxiety, and low self-esteem. It can also contribute to absence in schools, poor grades, and even suicide. In response to these problems, a group of students in Colorado worked with their school district to find ways to protect more students from the effects of bullying. From Boulder, Angelica Kalika has the story.
The Boulder Valley School District already has a policy against discrimination on the basis of race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, age, disability, or religion. But a group of concerned students noticed it left out an important category: physical appearance. Briggs Gamblin is the Director of Communications and Legislative Policy for the district.
It was decided that it made the most sense to incorporate body image, or what ultimately came to be called physical characteristics, in the district's non-discrimination ordinance, which was due for significant revision based upon changes in federal and state law and other areas. They can report it to any staff member in the building, but especially school administration, and the person who engaged in that activity will be dealt with on a case-by-case basis.
The changes were driven by a group of students who were working to promote positive body image in local schools. It was the kids themselves that took action to demand that students not be bullied for their physical appearance and presented this policy to their Board of Education.
In school, I've dealt with bullying based on my religion, my ethnicity.
That's Neil Sandu, one of the students behind the new policy.
But the bullying that hurt the most was based on weight or appearance, just because my whole life I've been told that the bullying based on religion or skin color has been wrong, because it's been in our anti-discrimination policies. The fact that the school board didn't count bullying based on weight as unjust, I kind of didn't know whether that was okay for students to treat me like that or others around me like that.
According to the youth advocacy group PACER, 1 in every 3 students in the U.S. is bullied. But that statistic does not reflect those that don't report and those that are chronically bullied. Student Sydney Brooks says that after she was bullied, she realized the problem didn't rest with how she looked, but how her peers treated each other.
I think I was tired of trying to change myself and trying to change my body and who I was, and I wanted to try to change our culture now.
It's not just the students in Boulder who are taking a stand against bullying. Julie Herzog, is the director of the Pacer National Bullying Prevention Center, and she says there is a national trend of students going to their local and state governments to make sure change happens.
If kids get involved with this issue and if kids start looking out for each other, they have a really significant impact on the outcome of a bullying situation and a positive impact. There's a statistic that almost 60% of situations will end when there's bystander intervention.
It's not always easy to get school officials to listen. Lori James Hawkins says she struggled to get the school district to pay attention to her concerns about the bullying of her daughter. She hopes other parents will have a different experience with the new anti-bullying policy.
The response from the teachers and the school administration tended to be, oh, you know, kids are mean, they'll grow out of it, it's, you know, don't worry about it. And then at the same time, I could see how that was affecting her, sort of negative way she was viewing her body. And it was awful for, as a parent, to not have the support of the school.
Boulder Valley is the first school district in Colorado to adopt an anti-bullying policy based on physical appearance. School districts in Michigan, North Carolina, Oregon, Texas, Washington, Massachusetts, Wisconsin, and California have already adopted a bullying based on physical characteristics clause in their non-discrimination policies. Angelica Kalika, FSRN, Boulder, Colorado.
A Dutch member of parliament appeared in court today to defend himself against the accusation of digital trespassing. He gained access to personal medical records, but says he did that to prove that the website had a security leak. He is now part of a discussion in the Netherlands about ethical hackers, those who go online in order to expose security lapses. FSRN's Peter Teffer reports.
The Dutch society is one of the most connected in the world. With almost 93% of the population having online access, it has the most internet users in the European Union. That also means that a lot of Dutch personal data is online. The Dutch government last year installed the National Cybersecurity Center to help make sure citizens' information is well protected. Another group that tries to improve online security is operating on the edges of what is legal. They were part of a recent panel discussion at a cybersecurity conference in The Hague organized by the National Cybersecurity Center. They are what's called ethical hackers, computer-savvy people who find testing security systems an interesting puzzle, says software developer Floor Terra.
For me, hacker is pretty neutral. You can be a white hat or a black hat, and white hats are more the ethical hackers, and the black hats are basically criminals. They abuse security problems. White hat hackers are mostly motivated out of curiosity, and then when you find such a problem in somebody else's system, you try to get it resolved because people can be hurt by that.
However, there are many companies and organizations that are not aware of the existence of benevolent hackers. Recently, several people who saw themselves as ethical hackers have been sued by the very companies they warned about a security leak. Henk Krol is an MP who discovered that personal files were easily accessible on a medical research center's website. He contacted the center responsible for the website, but also contacted the press. The center filed a complaint against Krol. Michel van Eten, who is a researcher at the Delft University of Technology, is careful to call MP Henk Krol an ethical hacker, because that is exactly what the judge needs to decide, based on the process of the disclosure.
It's clear that he didn't do this with a criminal motive. He reported the problem to the company, although from what I understand, he didn't try very hard. He just made one phone call. But he never publicly shared the data. He only showed that they were not properly secured.
The Dutch government now publicly acknowledges that not all hackers are criminal. In January, the National Cybersecurity Center published a guideline on ethical hacking, which it calls responsible disclosure. At the conference in The Hague, Minister for Security and Justice Ivo Opstelten referred to this guideline.
Outsider expertise can help safeguard the digital security of public and private parties. And that is very important in our society. So I will be actively promoting responsible disclosure and encouraging its use within central government.
The director of the cybersecurity department at Opstelten's ministry is Will van Gemert. He is responsible for the contents of the new non-binding guideline. He hopes that many companies adopt it, and that hackers who want to report a security weakness will no longer fear repercussions.
What we are aiming at is giving, at one hand, companies the possibility to be transparent about their policy, and we give some guidelines in this, how they should act. On the other hand, we make also clear to hackers or reporters what they can do and cannot do, the do's and don'ts in this field. And what we are aiming at is that in the future, a lot of companies and also reporters will act along those lines.
The government is not pursuing a change of the law, which means that ethical hackers can still be prosecuted. Digital trespassing will stay a legal offense. That's because it's not always clear whether a hacker has acted responsibly or not. In such cases, a judge will have to decide that. However, some in the hacker community find the guideline too non-committal. Some Dutch companies already have their own guidelines, like Marktplaats, an ad website similar to the American service Craigslist. Robin Schuil is one of the initiators of Marktplaats' guideline. He says his company welcomes the ethical hacker community's input, but only if they abide by the company's rules.
And for us, the most important criteria there, again, is private information from others. If you access that, we need to inform those others, and so we will have to file a report against you. If you don't, then we consider you an ethical hacker that is working with us to help us, and we might offer you a job.
That last remark was not a joke. Last year, a Dutch student helped Marktplaats solve a security leak and was rewarded with an internship there. However, not everyone thinks that reporting security leaks to the company is always the most responsible thing to do.
For example, imagine that you found a vulnerability in a car, let's say in an airbag of a car. I've actually had this debate with a so-called ethical hacker. And, you know, what they said is you disclose it to the car manufacturer. And I said, no, you tell the world immediately.
That's American hacker Jacob Applebaum. He argues it's more important to share your findings with the general public.
Companies have a lot of resources to protect their image, to lie to people, to, for example, fix the issue but maybe not share the fix freely with everyone. And it's only when the press is involved, it's only when the governments of the world see how serious the issue is and they can't deny it, then companies really go above and beyond almost always.
Whether the Dutch judiciary agrees with Applebaum might be revealed in a court case against Henk Krol, the Dutch politician that discovered the leak in the medical website. His court case is due to start on February 1st. Peter Teffer, FSRN, The Hague.
Peter sent us an update after today's hearing wrapped up. The prosecutor in the case demanded a fine of just over $2,000, and the judge is expected to rule on February 15th. In Texas, a protester with the tar sands blockade was released from police custody today after being arrested Thursday for disrupting a conference where a representative from TransCanada was scheduled to speak on pipeline safety. A video posted by activists shows Ramsey Sprague, a resident from Fort Worth, Texas, after he chained himself to a speaker by the side of the stage.
We may have been slap-suited. TransCanada sued me. And I'm standing here to say I'm not going to be silenced by TransCanada.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd just like to say I apologize for this disruption. We'll be playing some gentle music and be getting some bolt cutters, and we will resume as soon as we can. Unfortunately, we can't remove the speaker without shutting down the whole system, but we will be resuming as soon as possible. Thank you so much, and again, we apologize for this.
I really apologize that TransCanada is a terrible actor stealing land from my friends in order to facilitate a toxic tar sands pipeline that is full of holes. Like Swiss cheese in my friend's backyard.
Sprague is one of the activists named in a lawsuit brought by TransCanada that sought to restrict protests on its property and land the company claims for the project. The suit, called a strategic litigation against public participation, or SLAP suit, alleged that protesters cost TransCanada millions of dollars. The protesters settled the suit last week. For more, we're joined by Ramsey Sprague from Houston, Texas. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
You've been released from jail this morning. What were the charges against you, and what were the conditions of your release?
My charges were disrupting a meeting or procession. And the terms of my release are, I was bonded myself out. I have to return to court on February 20th and face my charges, plead guilty or not guilty, and move through the system accordingly.
At the protest yesterday, you specifically mentioned the slap suit that TransCanada brought against you and other individuals and groups. How has this lawsuit affected you, your action, or your response to the project?
Well, the slap suit is just an affront to free speech. TransCanada thinks that by bullying a small group of Texans that they're going to stop the grassroots movement against their toxic project. And that's simply not the case. They're dead wrong in that regard. What we've actually seen is a massive response in support of our work following the slap suit settlement. We were forced into a very, very difficult position as an organization, being people who want to advocate for the lives and livelihoods of Texans. It was very sad for us to know that the other named defendants, who really had nothing to do with the organization itself beyond their participation in acts of civil disobedience, that those individuals would be held responsible for all of the damages TransCanada was claiming over the lifetime of Tar Sands Blockade's activities.
Because Tar Sands Blockade was mentioned specifically in the suit, but there also were individuals who were mentioned by name.
Right. These were individuals who had been arrested in some of our earliest actions. In fact, every individual who was arrested in every single action that Tar Sands Blockade was ever involved in up until about the middle of October.
TransCanada brought this suit last fall. As we mentioned, it was settled last week. The company did not return FSRN's request for a comment or interview today, but a spokesperson was quoted in Bloomberg by saying the deal includes stopping attempts at chaining, shackling, binding, or attaching a person's body or any other object, article, or mechanism to Keystone equipment on Keystone property. Is that accurate, and what exactly does the settlement require?
Well, that is the terms of the settlement. All it requires is that we are not to be on what TransCanada claims as its land, as its easement for the Keystone XL pipeline in Oklahoma and Texas. It doesn't restrict any activities elsewhere. As you saw, I chained myself to a speaker yesterday on Marriott property.
At one point yesterday during that action, as you were being arrested, a woman asks you, why can't you work within the system in order to express your protest? Those are her words. What is your response to that?
Well, my response to her in that moment was simply, you know, I wish that the system was adequate enough to protect my brothers and sisters who are being poisoned in Canada, but what some community members there call a slow industrial genocide. Certainly a slow industrial genocide is something that government should be able to protect against. So certainly if the regulatory regimes were stringent enough to protect these people, then probably my work wouldn't be necessary.
I want to ask specifically about the project. According to TransCanada, the initial capacity of the Gulf Coast pipeline will be 700,000 barrels of oil per day, but that the ability will increase to 830,000 barrels a day. The company expects the pipeline to go into commercial service later this year in 2013. What are your concerns about the project, and specifically how tar sands oil is different than other petroleum products?
Well, sure. First and foremost, it's not oil. It is what the industry sometimes calls synthetic oil, but more correctly, it's diluted bitumen. It is bitumen, which is a hydrocarbon, an exotic hydrocarbon that has to be mined through very, very extreme extraction processes. TransCanada paraded this pipeline around as a conventional crude oil pipeline. They say it's no different than your grandpa's crude oil. In East Texas, loves its grandpa's crude oil. I'm from Texas, I understand that. But this is not crude oil. It will not behave like crude oil when it's released, and we have no way of cleaning it up.
Ramsey Sprague with Tar Sands Blockade in Houston, Texas. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Dory.
And thank you to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international stories. Their daily headlines and full newscasts can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that is our program for February 1st, 2013. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can also subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments, including our Idle No More sound clips from today, on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, please join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Morgan Yee. Today's show was produced by myself. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. And stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM.